Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 3rd, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Eve Zuckoff and Sam Houghton. We'll speak with Louisa Hufstadter at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent and Jeff Spillane at the Cape Cod Times. We'll speak with Rich Salzberg at the Martha's Vineyard Times and Mike Dean up at the State House. Right now, we're joined by WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning, Steve.
And Sam Houghton is with us as well. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Eve, let's start with you. On Monday in Hyannis, we saw a multi-faith memorial service for George Floyd. And this had a distinctly different feeling to it from some of the other rally-type events we've seen. You were there. Tell us a little bit about this event.
That's right. I mean, I think, first of all, this was a multi-faith vigil. That's really the jumping-off point that made this much different than some of the louder rallies that involve chanting and call and response. I mean, this was a much more somber event, and it was people of the Jewish, Baha'i, Christian, Buddhist faiths. They were all kind of congregating in this space with their leaders speaking into a microphone on Hyannis Village Green. There were about 100 people there, and really it was just a chance to speak about the killing of George Floyd and the killing of other Black and brown people by police through the language of religion, through the language of faith.
The mood was somber, as you say. What was the message that people were hearing there?
Yeah, at some of these events, it's about voting, or it's about police or community building. And this one's really distinctly about the individual and individual responsibility. So every person there was encouraged to really examine their own racism and learn to become anti-racist. That was really the message that was being urged by the rabbi, the reverend, man who leads people in Buddhist meditation. I mean, each of them were really talking about every individual taking a look at themselves.
I want to touch on some coronavirus news and updates here at the start. Yesterday, the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force held their weekly call. A lot of energy here focused around the holiday weekend.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And basically, this is a big weekend. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. This is a big moment, and businesses are really looking forward to this. I mean, this, because it's a Saturday, what they're kind of hoping for, what we're hearing from Wendy Northcross, CEO of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, is they're hoping to churn some momentum out of this weekend, that people will take week-long vacations, and then they'll have month-long vacations, and there will be businesses that can really recover for the rest of this. And part of the reason that the business community and our local officials are feeling hopeful is that people are coming to Cape Cod primarily from Massachusetts and New England, at least according to past years. So in 2018, the vast majority of people who take trips on Cape Cod are from mid-Atlantic states like New England, New York, New Jersey, 31% are from Massachusetts, and fewer than 2.1%, even lower than that actually, are from places like Florida. So what we're seeing is the people who tend to come to Cape Cod are in states where numbers of coronavirus cases are down, and that's really the hope this weekend, is that it can be a good, strong weekend for the business community, and, you know, weekend where there is no uptick in cases of COVID-19.
Well, going along with all this, hope is very clear messaging coming from the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force. Tell us what they're telling everybody, visitors and year-rounders alike.
Yes, it is a very clear message. Wear face masks, social distance, no big groups. I mean, it was actually described as profoundly disrespectful to Cape Cod to not stay with the program even while you're celebrating. And then as a side note, they said, be patient. There may be fewer people here this year. There may not be. And you know, lower your beach expectations, perhaps. You know, it's Cape Cod, it's the summer, everybody wants to be on the beach, everybody wants to be socially distant on the beach. Just be ready to be patient, and be ready to stay with the program.
Let's bring Sam Houghton in. Good morning, Sam.
Hey, Steve.
Sam, there's been tension in the business community as the state begins to reopen. That spilled over in Yarmouth over the past few weeks. There was a rally last month held by business owners and even a selectman calling for a faster reopening. And then the select board voted not to enforce these new state rules last week. What's happened since then?
Yeah, a lot's happened. So he said the selectmen vote basically said they would let restaurants and other businesses open as they see fit, you know, as long as they took in mind safety precautions. But the State Alcohol Beverage Control Commission, they actually came in and wrote up one local bar that was not in compliance. We still don't know what bar it was or what the charges really are here, but it came up at a recent selectmen's meeting. And from what we know, the bar owner is kind of confused. With that selectman's vote, he thought there wouldn't be this enforcement. So selectman had actually scheduled a discussion this week to bring that vote kind of back up, but they decided not to take any action on it. They basically said, you know, look, we're not enforcing what the state might or will, apparently.
Well, what about the Board of Health? They're actually in charge of enforcing public health in town. What's their stance on all of this?
Also this week, the health board sent, you know, a clear statement to the community that they would enforce these state laws. Public health is, you know, their entire mission. So if they get complaints, they're going to act. I spoke with the health agent there, and he says they've been having a lot of complaints, including people, you know, not wearing masks at beaches or in local establishments. So I think a bit of a mixed message from town leaders, but I think the underlying message here is there will be enforcement, whether by the state or the local health department.
Hey, Sam, also this week, the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy made some announcements about new programs around sharks. Some pretty cool stuff here, and timely, too, as we launch into the summer.
Yeah, pretty neat. So a few pilot programs are starting this summer. One idea is to launch these hot air balloons over local beaches. They'll be strapped with video cameras. It could give researchers like hours of shark footage. That's a collaboration with the State Division of Marine Fisheries and the Conservancy. They aren't sure when and what beaches these will be launched yet, but they say it'll be this summer. Also, collaboration is testing out new tagging technology. So right now, tag sharks might pass by what are called, you know, most people probably know, these acoustic receivers. They're set up all over Massachusetts with many on the Outer Cape. But they basically record when and where a shark passes by. The problem is, you know, researchers have to actually collect that data physically. And this new technology would allow the data to be uploaded kind of in real time, which obviously has a huge advantage. It could let lifeguards know when a shark might be nearby. Of course, you know, it's important to remember these are just tagged sharks that they would know about. There's still a lot of untagged sharks out there. And also pretty neat, the Conservancy is working on what they're calling a white shark forecast model. It's kind of like a weather forecast. You know, they hope to predict when and where sharks might congregate. It's going to take some work. They aren't expecting anything until next summer, but they're looking at things like water turbidity, water temperature, even looking at satellite data, you know, 10 years of shark tagging data. And they're going to hope to provide towns with kind of these weekly models next summer.
Hey, Sam, I also hear the Conservancy is offering private tours to find white sharks. Tell us about this.
Yeah, pretty cool. $2,500 for what they're calling expeditions. It does benefit shark research, but pretty neat. We've already heard a number of shark sightings this week. Even yesterday, they had to call swimmers out of the water in Dennis. So I'm guessing it could be, you know, a neat experience to get on one of those boats this summer.
That is WCAI Sam Houghton. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Eve Zuckoff, in Dennis this week, there was an early morning gathering on the beach to say goodbye, bon voyage, to a small group. You were there among the well-wishers. Tell us about this event.
Yes, that's exactly right. So when you're saying say goodbye, we're talking about say goodbye to seven turtles. Two of them are loggerhead sea turtles. Five of them were endangered Kemp's Ridley turtles. Basically, they had been found stranded and cold stunned this past winter by volunteers with Mass Audubon. Cold stunned being, you know, deeply hypothermic for weeks, so they're starving, they can't eat. And they had basically been rehabilitating at the New England Aquarium for 7-8 months. Some of them had pneumonia. I mean, these were really sick sea turtles. And while they were at the New England Aquarium, they were named after the elements. So this, the other morning, there was nickel, titanium, arsenic, boron. They were all part of this release, and they were finally well enough. So that was really an exciting moment to watch them kind of take off.
I've never been to one of these sea turtle releases. Describe the scene as they're released. What's it like?
Yeah, so they're first of all, they're trucked in from the aquarium in these little plastic containers, and then you kind of lift them out one by one. And actually, the loggerheads, which are named for their big heads, and they've got these yellow bellies. They're the bigger of the two. They were released first because they are the more anxious of the species. It's something I wouldn't have thought of. And so while
an
some
anxious
of them
turtle,
nickel,
yeah.
A more anxious turtle, yeah, you got to give it space. So while Nickel squirmed kind of straight into the water, did not look back, another turtle named Titanium just kind of lingered on the shore, smelling the sea air. And it was actually described to me as, yeah, this is actually really in keeping with Titanium's personality. A senior biologist described Titanium as, quote, just a different kind of turtle. But all of them made their way down the shore. You know, you put them on the sand where they can kind of take in the moment like that. And then they disappear into the water at some point. But what's nice is the very last part of them, specifically on the loggerheads that you see, is a little antenna. That's the last bit that dips under the water. And that's what researchers use to track the turtles by satellite for the next year. And they've done this successfully. Last year, a 340-pound loggerhead sea turtle named Munchkin was released from the same beach, and they've been able to track her up until just a couple weeks ago. She was seen pinging around the mid-Atlantic, and it really helps researchers have a sense of how well these endangered turtles are actually faring once they're released back into the wild.
And these are antennae that are mounted onto their shells, on their backs, right, sticking straight up.
Well, for loggerhead sea turtles, that's right. But for the Kemp's Ridley, the weight can be too much, so they're actually given little clips on their back feet, back legs that are used as the same effect.
Eve, Pride Month came to a close this week with the end of June. You talked to some folks with some special connections to Provincetown about how this was really a different kind of Pride Month. Tell us what you heard about.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key here is really when you think about Provincetown and what it means to people, you hear that it's just this space where for some who aren't out and aren't proud, it is the one space, the one day a year where they can go and be completely themselves. And even for others who have been, you know, married and are out and are proud, that's maybe the one place where they can go and openly kiss their same-sex spouse. And so without Provincetown's celebrations and parties and commemorations for also a very storied history, there have been people that have been feeling a little bit unmoored, I think. And part of that, though, has also created a vacuum. Without the celebrations, there's been a vacuum for people in Provincetown to think, and then specifically the LGBTQ community in Provincetown, to think about how it can support its Black and Brown members. Because at the same time this month, we're seeing nationwide protests over racial injustice and inequality. And so really what I heard is kind of a little bit of a reckoning of how does the LGBTQ community better support. And it's not a simple answer. And ultimately what I heard is it starts with taking a pause and reflecting and asking questions of the individual and questions of the community, and then ultimately acting in a way that's meaningful, acting in a way that does more than just display support and perform support, but actually achieves it and accomplishes it.
We've got a nice piece that's on our website for folks who want to hear with some nice voices there from Provincetown. Finally, Eve, you're our environmental and climate change reporter. You looked at a new tool out this week for predicting coastal flooding. Tell us about this and why it's different from what we've heard about before.
Yeah, I think the big headline here is in Falmouth, Dennis, Harwich, Wareham, by 2050, thousands more homes than previously thought could be at risk of flooding. And basically, we know this from this new tool called Flood Factor. And what's different about it, and it's a website created by scientists and experts, and really what's different about it, because many people may have heard of FEMA maps, Federal Emergency Management Agency, that comes out with its own flood risk maps. What's different about this map is it takes into account climate change. It assumes the scientific expectation of stronger storms, higher seas, and more frequent rains that are all consequences of climate change. FEMA leaves those out of its future predictions. So what you ultimately have is a scenario where 30 years from now, or actually right now, 10% of properties in Dennis Port are at risk of flooding, according to Flood Factor. When you look out to 2050, that increases by 40%. It increases fourfold. There are so many more homes in Dennis Port alone. In fact, it's the town in this state that is at highest risk of flooding by 2050, according to this new map. And really, I mean, it's something to be thinking about of how much will climate change reshape Cape Cod? And we've been asking this question for a while, and the answer in this measure, at least, is quite a bit.
That is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
A merger announced on Martha's Vineyard this week between two local nonprofits. Louisa Hufstadter at the Vineyard Gazette has the story. Hiya, Louisa.
Good morning, Steve.
Louisa, these are two groups focused on food access and food equity. Tell us what this is about.
Well, this is a big moment on the Vineyard for island nonprofits, which have been, there are many, many nonprofits on the island, and they've been working together, particularly in what you might call the food space, increasingly over recent years as the problem of food insecurity on the island has grown. It's intractable, and it is on the increase. Island Grown Initiative, which is probably at this point the larger of the two organizations, is the newer. It's only about 15 years old, and it started as an agricultural, sort of local agricultural, our own version of an extension program with a demonstration farm. And over the years, particularly since the executive director, Rebecca Haig, took the helm, they've been getting increasingly involved in things like food equity, food recovery. They have a very active gleaning program that already was in effect and produces an amazing amount of surplus food out of farmers' fields. Rebecca Haig used to be the president of the AIDS Action Committee in Massachusetts. She's a phenomenal organizer, communicator, and basically a visionary. And so I think is the new director of the Island Food Pantry, which is the other organization founded in 1981 just to help some islanders get through the winter months, fishers and farmers and summer workers. And over the years, they've been open in the summer for a number of years now. They're open 3 days a week. They're serving more people than ever before, and that is even after the shutdown from the COVID pandemic has been eased and many, many people went back to work. Food Pantry is seeing served, I think, something just a phenomenal factor of the number of people on the island at this point. We have a lot of hungry people here. And so they have developed, Katie Morris is the first professional director of this organization. They managed to get along for 38 years or something until they hired someone. And under her leadership. They've gone from, you know, pick up a bag of groceries to come in and get, you know, select what you need from this excellent stock of local and food bank food. Of course, now with the pandemic, it's back to here's a bag. But they're even working out home. Sorry, Steve. Those are the two organizations.
Well, those are the two organizations, and they have a little bit separate missions, even though they're kind of in alignment. What's the thinking behind bringing them together and merging them?
Well, as I was saying, the distribution network from the food pantry is one of their great strengths, since they've been developing it very strongly over the past couple of years, since they were simply a winter pickup location. And so now they're delivering to some families. They're getting ready to take advance orders from people so they get the right food to the right people. And that is a mantra of the Island Food Equity Network, which both of these organizations are a member of. Again, something Rebecca Hague started less than five years ago. I think they began meeting in 2016, all of the food organizations on the Vineyard and some businesses like local markets have been meeting to figure out ways to meet the need of the hungry islanders. So while the food pantry's been getting the groceries to families, the Island Grown Initiative has started things like a mobile produce market that goes to neighborhoods and a summer lunch program for kids, a free lunch program. This will enable Island Grown, with their logistics and their programming and their organizational strengths, and the food pantry with its you know, gravitas and its really growing distribution network, to join forces, get bigger, anticipate more need, help more people. And also as a corollary, make sure everybody's getting good food, not just the people who can afford a $5 pint of strawberries on the Vineyard in the summer.
When does this all start to happen logistically?
First of the year, it becomes official. They're going to be taking the next 6 months to continue organizing how it will actually work. Katie from the food pantry is going to join the board as of the Island Grown as a senior director. And the food pantry will continue to do its own thing. It simply will be a program of the Island Grown Initiative, or IGI, as we sometimes call it, or Island Grown.
That is Louisa Hufstetter at the Vineyard Gazette. Louisa, thanks for joining us this morning.
A pleasure. Take care, Steve.
Among the many pandemic-related cancellations, you can now count one that spans into next year. In fact, it spans the turn into next year. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with the story. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, of course, we're talking about Chatham's first night. Tell us about this.
Yeah, you know, I think we're all kind of looking forward to the end of 2020 a little bit at this point, but one thing we won't have to look forward to is Chatham's first night celebration. The first night committee announced this week that the need for social distancing on the streets of downtown Chatham and in the venues that they use, which range from churches to schools, and also the need for cleaning protocols, in between acts when people empty out of a venue and other people come in. They can't guarantee that they can do these protocols, and they can't guarantee, therefore, the safety of either their 300 volunteers or the several thousand revelers who every year attend the town's first night celebration. So actually, this would have been the 30th first night celebration in Chatham. I think it's probably the longest running one on the Cape, and it won't be happening at least as a live event. The organizers, Steve, as many other events have gone online, they're hoping to go a little bit virtual and at least do a few things to mark the new year. They're exploring some aspects like doing a drive-by noise parade, a virtual town photo, maybe getting some ice sculptures up in the downtown area for people who are around to view. And this way they hope to at least have some sort of first night New Year's celebration in town to carry on the tradition. And they say they're also looking for other ideas of how they could do this. And you can share any ideas you might have at info@firstnightchatham.com. And finally, they say they're really looking forward to returning to a traditional event in 2021.
Tim, let me ask you about another story briefly. Orleans could see a tattoo studio opening up with the efforts of a local entrepreneur and artist. And this would be the first tattoo studio between what, Hyannis and Provincetown?
Yeah, that's what we understand from between Hyannis and Provincetown. There aren't any tattoo studios currently. East Ham native Sean Shea, who is a body artist. He's got a degree from the Rhode Island School of Design, and he's an illustrator. He wants to open a tattoo studio in a former barbershop that he's planning on leasing on Main Street in downtown Orleans. He's worked in tattoo studios in Maine and at Mooncuster Tattoos, which is in Provincetown. And he recently, he told us he recently came back to the Cape full time and decided he wanted to explore the possibility of practicing his art here. And he's in the early stages of the process. He is scheduled to go before the town's site plan review committee this week. He said he's received a pretty good reception so far from town officials, but you know, we're not sure how the community is going to greet this idea. As soon as this story hit the paper, we got a sort of an anonymous email from a group calling itself Concerned Citizens for Orleans, saying they were worried about a tattoo studio opening up in town. So we're not sure how this is going to play out, but you know, we'll be following the process over the next few weeks to see where it goes.
That is Tim Wood. Tim, just briefly, he kind of makes a distinction between it being a tattoo parlor and a tattoo studio. He says this is not what people think of as a tattoo parlor.
Yeah, he considers himself an artist. He has a degree in illustration, so he's going to make this more of like a gallery where you could also get a tattoo. That's why he's calling it a studio and not a quote-unquote parlor. He's not interested in making this sort of a hangout for folks who you know, are into tattoos or whatever.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great weekend.
Data from the Outer Cape suggests that black people are arrested by police at a disproportionately higher level. The Provincetown Independent has the story, and we're joined now by Casey Myers. Hi, Casey.
Hello. How are you, Steve? Happy 4th.
Here we are. Can you believe it? Casey, tell us about the data your reporters looked at for this story.
Okay, great. The police departments in Provincetown, Truro, Wellesley, and East Ham really cooperated with us. They gave us the data that they keep on arrests and traffic citations and broken down by race. And what we found is that the Outer Cape is not so different from the rest of the country. The statistics show that while our black population is less than 3%, their arrests account for 8 to 12% of the total arrests in 2019. to break that down even further, less than 2% of the populations of Provincetown and Wellfleet are black, but they made up 9% of arrests. In Truro, 2.2% of the population is black, but they made up 12% of arrests. And in East Ham, it was 2.6%, making up 8% of arrests. Traffic stops data was similar in that the amount of black driver stops was disproportionate to the racial makeup of each town. And that's just the data. The writers are careful not to draw conclusions from this data because we don't really know everything. We know it doesn't really tell us everything. And in fact, that's what the police department said, is that it's really unfair to compare a year-round population of one racial group or another with arrests, since we do get so many visitors and tourists. And of course, we hear that. That's absolutely a point. We don't think there is a huge influx of black or brown people in the summer. The truth is, we just don't know. So this is definitely part one in looking at policing and racial issues on the Outer Cape. Part of the story, too, was we kind of went into the Wayback Machine a little bit to tell a story that's pretty well known in Wellfleet. 20 years ago, the former police chief, Richard Rosenthal, who was a former New York City police officer, pulled his gun on Mamadou Sow, an African student living in Wellfleet at the time with Panchita Peterson, who was herself an Afro-Caribbean woman. And the story is completely different depending on if you talk to Panchita Peterson or Richard Rosenthal, even 20 years later, the facts, they can't even agree on some of the very basic facts, but I'm just kind of picking and choosing one version, which is or what I think is sort of a middle version, which is Sal was walking on a bike trail when police saw him and tried to get him to stop and talk to them, but he was wearing headphones at the time, so he didn't respond to the police orders. But like I said, these facts are really different depending on who you talk to. And so if nothing else, it just shows us how far we are from really, how far we are from really getting an understanding and how important it is to keep telling stories like this from as many perspectives as possible.
So important to keep telling these stories. And Casey, thank you for you and your reporters pulling out that data from the Outer Cape. It's fascinating to hear some of those numbers and think about what they could mean. Even as you say, the context is a little bit hard to put it in, but those are strong numbers.
It is. I mean, and if you look at national data, 26% of arrests in America are of Black people, but they make up, that's double the population that they make up in the United States. So we're not that, that's what it tells us, that we're not that different. We're not immune.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent with the story. Casey, thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. State Senator Julian Sear has tested positive for COVID antibodies. From the Cape Cod Times, Jeff Spillane has this story and more. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Jeff, tell us, what do we know about Senator Sear's COVID-19 antibody test?
Sure. I spoke with the senator last night about this, and he did confirm to me that he has tested positive this week for the antibodies, the COVID-19 antibodies. It does appear, Steve, that he was likely fairly ill with coronavirus back in March. He told me he had fevers, chills, some breathing issues. This all on or about March 16th, but he had already been quarantined. He said he had just come back from a family vacation in Florida. But he was also aware that there had been several people that he knew on the Outer Cape that had, and he socialized with, that had symptoms. And you got to remember at this time, Steve, that's when tests weren't readily available unless you were, you know, practically dying or met very stringent requirements. But what's interesting here is about a week before he took ill, Steve, he spent a day away from Beacon Hill, who was down here in the district, and that was on March 10th. So he was conducting office hours in Orleans. He had a meeting at the National Seashore and also a public meeting that night in Wellfleet. He estimates he came in contact with about 120 people, which he was quite concerned about, obviously, but was told by a physician that he likely would not have been contagious until March 14th, which is just some good news there. But one of the reasons I think that the senator really wanted to come out and talk about this was he wanted to encourage people, wanted to encourage his constituents, if you think you had symptoms, even back as far as he did in March, you really should talk to your primary care physician and ask whether it makes sense to get this test.
I want to talk about another thing that Senator Sear is involved with. He's also involved in a bit of a dust-up between him and the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates over the work of the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force. The county delegates invited Sear to brief them, and Sear declined, and he declined with rather a, you call it a testy email exchange. Tell us
about
this.
He had quite a week, sure. Yeah, about 2 weeks ago, the Assembly voted in favor of a resolution, which, by the way, is just a non-binding opinion, opposing restrictions in place here against for businesses in Massachusetts. They said it deprives county residents and business owners of property, liberty, and livelihood. They ask our delegation to, and I quote here, immediately act to reverse the unfettered power being exercised by the executive branch of state government, Charlie Baker. And so that didn't sit well with Sear. You know, he's a leader. He's a leader on the reopening task force here on the Cape, and he also sits on the state's COVID-19 health equity task force. And when asked to come before the assembly this week to speak on a status of the task force, that's when the sparks started to fly. He politely declined, but then we can use politely here, I guess. But he got a few digs in. He said that the recent activity, the sanction that they had approved at the assembly, had led him to question whether the assembly had any value or merit, and referred to the resolution as insulting. He contends that the vote by doing that, by voting on the resolution, it undermines all the hard work being done by county departments, the Cape Cod Commission, Chamber of Commerce.
Well, really, as you say, Julian Sear, now kind of the spokesperson for the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force, really spearheading a lot of the efforts around COVID-19 safety and kind of marshaling a lot of moving parts here in the county to try to move everybody past the pandemic. And here's the Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates saying they kind of want to throw out the guidelines and just get back to business, which I guess, I mean, we can see a little bit of how that's going in other parts of the country, it seems like, right now.
Yeah, and the county administrator, Jack Unis, said that as well. All we need to do is take a look at down south to see why we're doing what we're doing here. Sear also said there's about a dozen county employees that are involved in these reopening task force calls twice a week, so the assembly should have known what's going on. And, of course, Suzanne McAuliffe, who's the assembly speaker, she said she was surprised about the response and that the personal attacks weren't necessary. She also said that the delegates only moved this resolution. And I can't say it's not all the delegates, you know. Several towns, especially in the lower and outer Cape, did not vote for this. They were only moving on this resolution because businesses in towns they represented asked them to. But, yeah, interesting week.
Yeah, interesting week for Julian Sear there, particularly. That is Jeff Spillane from the Cape Cod Times. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
A bank on Martha's Vineyard had a Black Lives Matter sign up, which it then took down after receiving a complaint. Now it says it will go back up. Rich Salzberg from the Martha's Vineyard Times has the story. Hi, Rich.
Hey, good morning from Vineyard Haven, Steve.
Rich, this story goes back and forth a number of times. Explain the timeline of what happened here for us.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. Earlier this week, an email chain was shared with us by an Eggertown resident named Jane Chittick. Chittick seemed interested in spotlighting her discussions with the bank with bank officials regarding Black Lives Matter signage that was affixed to a window of the Rockland Trust in Eggertown Center. In the chain, Chittick wrote that she was offended by the signage. She gave several reasons. For example, in her opinion, Black Lives Matter was no longer peaceful, and she also asked if bank staff had similar signs on their lawns. The first email that CEO Chris Odlifson sent basically established he and Chittick's brother enjoyed sailing. In his next email, he established he was in support of Black Lives Matter, as was the bank. He questioned whether Chittick was receptive to this message. Not long after, the branch manager, D. Lander, wrote that the signage was coming down. He told us this was because of sun damage and because it was due to be rotated out. The signage was said to be 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper. The ones that went up yesterday appear to be similar. The question that arose from this is whether the bank, perhaps at the local level, caved to Chittick or not. Our reader comments on this article are pretty numerous. Some people found her position hateful. Other people were sympathetic. The story's still unfolding.
So now the sign is back up in the bank. Is that right?
That's correct. It's a triptych of 8.5 by 11 pieces of perhaps laminated paper in the windows that face Main Street in Eggertown.
And is the bank saying that this is that's going to be up there for a while now, or did you get a sense of whether this is a part of a policy decision, or is this they just sort of letting the local bank figure this out?
No, I mean our sense is that Black Lives Matter is supported at the corporate level of Rockland Trust. It seems that they rotate these every 2 weeks, and it's unclear how long this one will be up. The branch manager previously mentioned that gay pride signage, had a 2 week rotation on a window, so they may have some preset sign rotation for all sorts of displays like that.
Is there a sense that Chittick, who the woman who initiated this, is she Do you have a sense whether she's done with this now, or is this moving on?
I would tend to doubt it. She is rather vocal, she's been quite vocal on other issues in Edgartown, including an electric bus charging station on Church Street, and I believe she's also been able to join that committee. So she seemed keenly interested in sending this email chain to a number of people, which it was, and that's how it came to our attention. So I wouldn't be surprised, but I wouldn't want to speculate.
Rich Salzberg joining us from the Martha's Vineyard Times this morning. Rich, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve.
The coronavirus pandemic is surging through parts of the U.S., but in Massachusetts, it appears the vigilant social distancing and other measures enacted by the governor have curbed cases. We had our first day in months with no recorded COVID-19 deaths this week, and Governor Baker lifted the self-quarantine restriction for travelers arriving in Massachusetts from a handful of states. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean about this and more.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, Mike, which states did the governor highlight when he lifted the 14-day quarantine restriction earlier this week?
Well, it's New England, the New England states, and New York and New Jersey. So these are all states that are seen as having similar trends in the decline of the spread of the coronavirus as Massachusetts has. So transmission rates would generally be the same in this kind of larger community. It's also important to remember that, you know, these quarantine orders, instructions, advisories were impossible to maintain. No one was really enforcing these types of things. One of the biggest efforts to kind of get this changed was from the lodging industry, places like Cape Cod, like the Berkshires, kind of applying to Governor Baker and saying that travelers from out of state didn't want to come and book a vacation in Massachusetts, even though, you know, restaurants and hotels are now open because of this 2-week, quarantine advisory. Someone from New York City isn't going to, you know, rent a place for a week or two in Provincetown when the state allegedly has them self-quarantining for 2 weeks once they arrive. So doing away with that has kind of led the way for a lot of tourism and lodging to renew their efforts and hopefully salvage this season.
I want to talk quickly about masks because I think there might be some confusion, especially for those who may be visiting from out of state, because we have state guidelines, we hear recommendations from federal health officials, and then we also have some cities and towns that have enacted their own guidelines on masks, like Nantucket, where people who are in the downtown need to have a mask on regardless of how far away they are from someone else. So what does the governor advise people to do about wearing face masks?
The state's face covering guidance has been pretty consistent. It's that you should have a face mask on if you cannot socially distance. If you can't keep 6 feet away from somebody, you should have it on, you know, when out in public. Certainly, we've seen restaurants and retail stores that have been reopened in phase two have been requiring face masks while inside. That is something that we've seen working fairly well. I think no one would be surprised to have to put on a face covering to get into a convenience store or into a, you know, department store or a restaurant. Of course, the restaurant restrictions are that you have to have the face covering on, any time except for when you're actually at the table itself. So if you know, coming and going from the table, you're required to wear it. So the state is very broad about that kind of advice. Cities and towns can put fines for things like face coverings. They can instruct visitors, like you suggested, that to in the downtown area always have one on. So you would be best to pretty much always have one on you and then check out the municipal rules, what that town is enforcing to avoid, you know, crossing the local enforcement barrier there.
Mike, there's been some news coverage nationwide of impending evictions since it is the beginning of the month and mortgages and rents are due, and eviction moratoriums in some states are ending. What's happening here in Massachusetts?
The eviction and foreclosure moratorium in Massachusetts is still in place until August 18th. That is when it will expire. Now, the governor can then extend that. He can extend it in 90-day periods. Beyond that, throughout the course of the state of emergency, which is, of course, no end in sight to that, we don't know if Baker is going to extend that just yet. That's something he has said that he'll decide later on. He's certainly been asked about it. Now, Democratic lawmakers certainly want to extend this. They're floating a number of different bills to the legislature that would enforce this and extend it by law, take that authority out of the governor's hands and just make it law as is to kind of extend that for different periods of time. It's something that is expected to get addressed. Whether or not the legislature has the capacity to do that so late in their session remains to be seen, especially because that power has already been granted to the governor. It's rare that lawmakers would then take the power back and give the authority to themselves. So as you know, every rent day that comes by, I think there's going to be some nail biting, but that this really has to do with what does Baker decide before that August 18th deadline.
In other news, Massachusetts is one of many jurisdictions considering vote by mail, and that's to ease crowds at polling places coming up in November. Is Massachusetts going to have mail-in voting for both the primary and the general election this year?
It certainly looks that way. Again, this is something that we have to see how Baker decides whether or not he'll sign this bill that's kind of shuttling through the legislature. It should be on his desk relatively soon, if not already. Basically, it would allow city clerks to send out applications to every registered voter. Those voters would then request, you know, a Democratic or Republican ballot for the primaries, and then they would get a general ballot in the mail via the same system. The contention here is the pressure it puts on city and town clerks. Those are the election infrastructure, really, in Massachusetts, are these municipal clerks who run all this voting. It's simply a lot of man hours. It's a brand new system. It's something that, you know, expanding this to a point where these city and town clerks can, you know, open all these envelopes, send all the applications, receive all the ballots in a very secure way is going to add an awful lot of cost. So if Baker does object to this, it'll probably be the what is it known as an unfunded mandate for cities and towns that have to deal with this new program. So we'll see what he has to say. But the enthusiasm from the legislature, I believe both votes were unanimous or nearly unanimous. So there is bipartisan support on this type of thing. So the governor will either sign it, let it go into effect, or he might make some changes and tweaks on his own. It's also important to remember that the legislature is running out of time to override any decisions and any vetoes Baker makes. So the governor himself may have the final word on whether or not we get voting by mail this year.
So we'll have to keep an eye on that, plus other initiatives that they have on their desks. July, I have this feeling, is going to go pretty fast, and suddenly the legislature will be in recess. Until then, Mike D. and our State House reporter, have a great weekend. Happy 4th of July.
You too, Catherine.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with reporter Mike Dean up at the State House. That is our show for today. I want to thank my guests, WCAI's Eve Zuckoff and Sam Houghton. We heard from Louisa Hufstadter at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent and Jeff Spillane at the Cape Cod Times. We heard from Rich Salzberg at the Vineyard Gazette and Mike Dean at the State House. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio for masterfully stitching together the many pieces of the program into a seamless whole. And to my family for letting me do all the talking for the past hour. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.